So we are talking about authors and adjectives. And boy, if you're an economist, it's easy to get an adjective in your own name, Keynesian. Think about that for a moment. We're joined by Alan Beatty, World Trade Editor of the Financial Times, my favorite newspaper, and author of False Economy, A Surprising Economic History of the World. First of all, Alan Beatty, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
And secondly, you know, I think of this book as kind of a guns, germs, and steel of economics, the Jared Diamond book about interesting sort of facts about the places where civilizations began and how they determined the future course of events. We're used to thinking of economics as a kind of incremental affair where markets go up and maybe markets go down, sometimes a little more steeply, sometimes they drop off the cliff. But in general, it's an incremental narrative of the procession of economy. This book is all about enormously significant forks in the road that are significant and evident only in hindsight. Why are there so many forks in the road that aren't apparent until much, much later on?
Well, I think one of the things is that economists aren't kind of very good at analyzing history. They're not very good at analyzing narratives. They tend to think of all economies as being the same, and you do the same thing to each one, and it will respond in the same way, you know? Whereas in reality, what tends to happen is countries tend to make decisions and not even necessarily being aware of those decisions. And those kind of get them on paths. And once they're on a particular path, it's kind of hard to get off it. It's not impossible to get off it, and there are kind of big, significant decisions that they can take. But once you're on a path, you tend to get stuck on it. And I think it's kind of quite difficult once you're within a particular country actually to see the decisions that have been taken in the past. You know, you always tend to compare where you are with where you were rather than what right. could have happened if you'd taken a different path or, you know, where a different economy is now.
Well, one of the best stories in your book is how Argentina and the United States were actually neck and neck, sort of, at a certain point in history, and then that really, really changed, and you explore some of the reasons. Let's take a look at the U.S. and Argentina.
Yeah, I mean, back in the 19th century, you know, they were pretty much equivalent. I mean, the if you look at the makeup of Argentina today, a large part of its population are Italians, and quite a few Irish as well. And you know, if you were kind of poor Italian or Irish emigrant at the end of the 19th century, it was a genuine toss up: were you going to go to Buenos Aires or to New York? You know, were you going to go to the Pampas or to the Prairie? And they look kind of quite similar. You know, they had big temperate grasslands, very rich in natural resources, new world economy, very good at farming, and so on and so forth. And, you know, and as late as the 1930s, Argentina was one of the 10 richest economies on earth. And then, having made a couple of bad decisions, things started to go wrong, or things had actually been kind of going wrong behind the scenes for quite a long time. And as the old saying goes, you know, Argentina is the only country in history to have gone from the third world to the first and then back again.
What were the decisions that Argentina made that were so decisive?
Well, I mean, from the beginning, the way in which it kind of settled the frontier was not particularly helpful in the sense that it essentially recreated a kind of European aristocracy with vast land holdings and so on, while the US was populating it through things like the Homestead Act with these kind of small, aspirant, high productivity sort of farmers. But, I mean, the really bad decisions it made were during the 30s when, you know, the model it had developed, which was exporting farm products to Europe, kind of collapsed because of the Depression. And from that, they drew the conclusion, well, relying on the rest of the world for trade was a mistake. We should turn in on ourselves. And so they erected these gigantic tariff walls. They said, we're going to industrialize behind these enormous kind of import tariffs. And what essentially happened is that while the rest of the world was kind of recreating the global trading system after the Second World War, they tried to go it on their own. And they're just not big enough to do it on their own, and economies that cut themselves off just don't grow as fast anyway.
So protectionism and maintaining a landed class distinguished the U.S. and Argentina, and the U.S. has never looked back. Let's talk about natural resources for a moment. You suggest that oil, and particularly diamonds, work against democracy, and that the historical evidence for that is all over the world.
Yeah, that tends to be, on average, the kind of the outcome that particularly if you start off with nothing else but oil or diamonds, two things tend to happen. I mean, one, it unbalances the rest of the economy because all this money floods in to buy the oil or diamonds, and that makes you uncompetitive doing anything else. And two, it tends to poison the politics of your economy because all that happens is everyone fights out with each other for control of the oil or the source of oil or diamonds. But I must say, I think if anything, the pendulum's kind of swung a bit far with this, and I think too many people now are utterly pessimistic about oil or diamonds economies and say they can never succeed. Whereas one of the contrasts I bring out in the book is between the African country of Botswana, which became independent in 1965 with almost nothing, then discovered diamonds, and then became the fastest growing economy on earth for 30 years. And you contrast that with Sierra Leone, which was actually another former British colony, who also became independent, had nothing but diamonds, and then managed to succumb to a dreadful civil war and became one of the poorest economies on earth. So really, oil and diamonds on average are not good for the economy, but you can certainly choose to manage them well or choose to manage them badly.
Well, and the U.S. was a great oil producer in the early part of the 20th century. We're less so now. We still produce an enormous amount of oil, but it didn't necessarily have an anti-democratic consequence to the United States, maybe in Texas, but not in the United States broadly. Well, what decisions do you think will become those forks in the road that are being made today in this economic environment?
Well, if countries retreat to protectionism again, and I must say, just at the moment, I'm actually quite optimistic that they won't. I'm quite optimistic that we won't see a wholesale retreat to protectionism of the kind that we saw during the Great Depression. But if we do see that, that would certainly be one of those forks in the road that would take countries kind of down a low growth path. But I think the most important thing in the short term is precisely how we deal with the financial crisis. And in particular, the experience, I think, of the Depression is that when you're dealing with some extraordinary crisis like this and a massive shortfall in demand and confidence and so on, you err on the side of hitting with as much ammunition as you can, as much stimulus as you can, and you err on the side of kind of aggressive interventions into the financial system to get them going again. I think a real danger, as with Japan during the 1990s, for example, is that all the interventions are kind of too slow and that money is dribbled out year after year. And I think that will kind of cause quite a serious loss of confidence in the overall system.
Yeah, well, speed is definitely a theme of the changes that are taking place now. Finally, you know, we've been talking about authors that become adjectives. It's really easy if you're an economist to get an adjective. Keynes, right? Keynesian?
Yeah, I'm not
what?
Sure.
How come economists get a pass here?
I'm not sure there were that. I'm trying to think of other ones which are very well known. I'm
Friedman-esque?
Not sure beyond Keynesian. Friedman-esque, you possibly Friedman-esque.
Anyone sure suggested that, BDS?
I'd love to be BDS-esque, really. If you'd like to start that as an adjective. I'd be happy to leap on that particular bandwagon, believe you me.
All right,
but,
well, read
I'm not sure, and if you're enough economists are kind of household names that they're really going to become adjectives.
Well, I will suggest read False Economy and then you decide. Is there an adjective? Beatian? Alan Beatty is the author of The False Economy, A Surprising Economic History of the World. He's also a world trade editor of the Financial Times. He joined us from Washington. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you.
So, author J.G. Ballard died over the weekend, but even before his death, the Collins English Dictionary added Ballardian. Who else deserves an adjective?
Latasha Bay here calling from New Jersey. And I'd like as an adjective, Philip Roth, Rothian, invoking ideas of Northeast Jewish male Woody Allen type.
I love that. And why are all these adjectives describing male authors? Come up with some adjectives for writers, especially women, or use an adjective, a writer adjective in a sentence. Morrisonian, Jungian, Austenesque. Danielle Steely, you come up with it. All the way from Israel.
I feel like I've been Hockenberry.
Shy is listening to us. Send us this email. Wolfian for old Virginia Woolf. That's a great one. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Hockenberry me if you like. If you missed anything, we're always on here at The Takeaway. We've got the podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.